the equivalent to our Duxbury tables in personal injury cases are the Ogden tables. And at the moment, the 8th edition has been published and they have a minus 0.25% rate of return in England and Wales. They're different in Northern Ireland, etc. But in England and Wales, it's minus 2.5% as against our positive 3.75%.
Welcome to the Resolution Podcast. This month, we are joined by Farhana Shahzadi and Sally Harrison KC to consider how to approach spousal maintenance cases, including issues around quantum, Duxbury, and specifically whether menopause should have an impact on the maintenance award. Farhana, would you mind introducing yourself first?
Yes, sure. I am Farhana. I've practiced for 20 years. I'm a family law partner at Struthers. I'm also on Resolution's National Committee and Publications Committee. And the Publications Committee is releasing a spousal maintenance handbook this year, which I think is going to be essential. And this makes the podcast quite interesting, particularly from my point of view. But also importantly and passionately, I'm the founder of the Family Law Menopause Project, which considers the intersection of family law and menopause and how that may impact some clients on the family law journey.
And Sally?
Hello, thank you for inviting me to speak today. I am a barrister. I practice in primarily Manchester. My chambers are based in Manchester, but I work all around the country. I've been at the bar now for more than 30 years, and I took silk 14 years ago. And most of my working practice has been specialising in matrimonial finance cases. And the whole time I've been in silk, all I've done is matrimonial finance cases up and down the country. I've also been called to the bar in Northern Ireland, and I was lucky enough to appear in the Court of Appeal in the Cayman Islands, interestingly, about a maintenance case. So thank you for inviting me today.
Thank you. We're really pleased to have you both here. Let's dive right in at the tricky part. How do we know the appropriate bracket for the maintenance award? Sally, may I come to you first on this issue?
Yes, of course. Well, as family practitioners, we know that when we're looking at a maintenance order, it's because need requires there to be a maintenance order, because otherwise income isn't open to being shared between the parties. And of course, that's a very easy statement to make. By far the bigger question, and the one that is the most vexing for us as matrimonial finance practitioner, is where do we begin to assess that need? How do we know what the amount of the need is going to be? And the quote I always give to my clients when they look at me, when I tell them that there's a risk that there's going to be a maintenance order, if they're the paying party, and they sort of look at you helplessly and say, well, how much is it going to be? And I say, well, we've got lots of guidance. There's a very important decision called FS and FS, where the judge said that the amount of maintenance is referable to the length of the judge's foot. And they look absolutely askance. And I smile and say, no, it's far more scientific. But knowing full well that, of course, this is an entirely discretionary area of the law, and one that therefore makes it incredibly difficult for us on the ground with our clients to give them clear and cogent advice and actually get right the figure ultimately that's referable to the length of the judge's foot. More recently, Mr. Justice Peel in WCNHC has considered this, and he described needs as an elastic concept. Perhaps that's just a different way of being referable to the length of the judge's foot. But what he did do is he did give some guidance to us. He obviously went back to the case of Sharman, consideration of financial need, obligations and responsibilities, things we know very well. Where they sit, of course, will depend on a number of different factors. For example, the presence of children, the ages of the children, and then that vexed question that we all know so well, the standard of living enjoyed before the breakdown of the marriage, which I'll come back to. The ages of the parties, obviously always very important. Any physical or mental disability. The standard of living, I think, is one of the hardest things, because Whilst we're told, and Mr Justice Mostyn has reminded us, it's not a lodestar, nevertheless, we can't ignore the fact that the Family Justice Council has put it up there. If resources allow, if it's a long marriage, then the court ought to aim to have the standard of living reflected in the amount of income and housing needs of the parties. Of course, Miller and McFarlane, Baroness Hale said exactly that setting needs was it should be referable to the standard of living if possible. Looking at that then in practice, I think that causes a real issue. Certainly I found recently that there's been a tendency to manipulate budgets. So if you're the potentially paying party, you see budgets that are ludicrously low in order to be able to argue, well, our standard of living was very low, very modest. And then if you're likely to be the receiving party, putting in budgets that are sky high with a view to establishing that you live this incredibly luxurious lifestyle. And certainly in my practice, in the cases that I've fought recently, it's an increasing trend to see analysis of bank statements, tables and tables saying, this is what we spent. This is the standard of living we had during the marriage. And it's almost become, in my view at least, a bit of a sideshow when you come to assessing needs, this whole what we did and didn't do. And I haven't found any judicial continuity in relation to this. I've got some judges who've said, oh, well, if your husband needs X, you need the same. I've got other judges that have said, no, I'm going to start effectively with a clean sheet, but I'm going to look back at bank statements to give me some idea of what, or analysis of bank statements to give me some idea of what's been spent. And so I think that it's almost become, if you like, a little bit of a Linus's blanket for people to go back to standard of living, just because it's so difficult otherwise to know where on earth to begin. But of course, that all depends on what your budgets are saying and what the evidence comes out at. So there isn't a one size fits all. Unfortunately, judges' feet vary in sizes, which it does make it difficult for us.
Tiny question just on that, Sally. I think it's really, really interesting. Because the wording is referable, isn't it? It's not replicate. And do you think that's an interest? Do you think people do have a tendency to expect that the standard of living will simply continue in a straight line? And is that what you're seeing?
For sure. I think that's absolutely right. I think that particularly where you have a very long marriage, where people have lived at a very high standard, I think in those circumstances, judges actually are quite sympathetic to making reference back to the standard of living and not trying to replicate it, I agree, but certainly having it in mind when they're looking at what needs are going forward. In shorter marriages, I think sometimes there is an expectation that particularly where the standard of living has been particularly lavish and particularly enjoyable for one spouse who perhaps hasn't been working, had the benefit of perhaps a very enjoyable lifestyle with luxury cars, fancy holidays. I think in those cases, it's very much harder to manage expectations of the client and certainly to persuade judges to be generous in terms of how far they go with perhaps a rather ambitious income needs budget.
Thank you, Farhana. When we're talking about needs, then what do you think that we need to be factoring in? I mean, there's the budget, but what else is there that goes to needs?
Well, I think needs are elastic, as Sally has said, and we've got the introduction of Section 25A, which in fact came in 1984, so a little bit after the 1973 Act. Talking about the term will be to allow the payee to adjust without undue hardship. But we're not really getting any assistance on needs, are we? I often do look at SS and NS, as most practitioners probably do, and Nicholas Mostyn's, 11-point plan, where he talks about standard of living being relevant to the quantum of spousal maintenance, but not decisive. And I find in practice with the needs, there's a lot of push and pull. I suspect what we should do as practitioners is to go back to the last 12 months' bank statements to see what actually is being spent so we can establish what the need is going to be. But for lots of people, the separation, the application, the financial remedies application, there's a gap. And women, wives, payees, are often paired back anyway. So the bank statements don't always give us a clue. So it's very, very tricky, I find. And in fact, the whole issue of spousal maintenance is, of course, quite difficult.
But on getting into topics we're going to be looking at later, needs isn't just budget. It's also its stage of life. Whether retirement is around the corner, it's health. Whether that's menopause, it's earning capacity, isn't it? Likelihood of being able to go back to work. It's all of that stuff as well that we need to sort of factor in and get in our Forms E.
Agreed, Simon. But I think what we're increasingly seeing is a very, quite a hawkish culture when it comes to spousal maintenance. So one can prepare quite elaborate budgets, elaborate thinking and planning, really just to be cut back by the courts quite early on. And of course, we know the case law is quite hawkish. I think when you look at it in the 1990s, there was a more generous legal climate, particularly for the payee, particularly for the wife. And, generally there was considered to be long-term maintenance. When I started practice 20 years ago, I would regularly see joint lives orders. And that was on the basis that there was dependency of children. There may be an older payee, late 40s into her 50s. There was disability issues. Now, menopause wasn't factored, and we'll come to that. But the disability issues, health issues, you'd see long-term maintenance awards. We had the case of Flavelle, CNC. These were 1997 cases where there was a recognition that it would be inappropriate to terminate spousal maintenance for a payee into her 50s, that there would be health and loss of employment to take into account, that we should have facts based on evidence, not crystal ball gaze. So we did have this range of very helpful cases, but since then we have, of course, rowed back from that. But I do agree with you, Simon, we should be considering a range of different factors, and age is one of them. Needs, and of course, needs are elastic, they change with age as well, don't they?
But Sally, we're always being taught with what Farhana said that I hear over and over again, and it seems right to me that it's harder to get a joint lives maintenance order. And then we're told that there's regional variation and that, it's a London thing or it's not. What's your experience?
Such an interesting issue, this, because I do remember not that long ago how, and in the days that I'm sure many of your listeners will remember, when you could choose where you issued proceedings. So, as a northerner, there would always be a race to issue out of the principal registry. And the reason for that was because that's where you were almost guaranteed, if you were for a wife, to get a joint lives maintenance order. And it was commonplace. And they really, really weren't commonplace in the north, in that regional way, because district judges simply didn't think that there should be joint lives maintenance order. And there really was, for quite a sustained period of time, a north-south divide about how much maintenance should be awarded. And then, of course, the decision of SS and NS, I think, was really the beginning of the pendulum swinging back. And the question, of course, for everybody is, has it now actually swung too far? So I was recently involved in a case that went to appeal in the High Court where a relatively young woman in her early 40s, but still with a young child and older children, because she'd got together with her husband when she was very young indeed. So although she was a relatively young woman, it had been a very long marriage, and the youngest child was still in primary school. And the judge at first instance had awarded a full life Duxbury, and the husband mounted a wholesale attack on the fact that the judge had awarded a whole life Duxbury for a woman in her 40s and how wrong that was. And he got permission to appeal, and the grounds for the permission were that the judge assessing the appeal was that the wife was young, that she had an earning capacity, that the judge might not have properly assessed her earning capacity, and that maybe there shouldn't have been a full life Duxbury. Representing the wife, I'm pleased to say that on a full hearing of the appeal was dismissed on that particular point. But it really brought into sharp focus something that Hannah said, which is, the pruning of a budget, because if you're for a wife and you have a budget that's pruned back really quite significantly to put into a Duxbury calculation. But then there's an argument of do you have to step down again because you're a young woman? It really brings into sharp focus this whole issue of, well, how long is your period of dependency? Is it a full life? Is it a term? And if it's going to be a term, how long is that going to be? And should it be extendable or not?
Well, let's jump forward then and hear what the two of you have to say about terms of maintenance, because I think we're all saying that terms have gone down. So what's your insights about what the appropriate factors are to determine what the term is going to be for the order? Would you like to go first, Fahana?
Well, I'm thinking of some cases which have been on my desk, and it's with huge disappointment, in fact, I've had a range of wives over the last few years, actually probably post-SS and NS, if I'm honest, where they have been wives in their early 50s who have achieved nothing more than five-year terms. And I couldn't actually, you know, as a practitioner, understand why they would be ranging it around 5 years. And I imagine the thinking, which actually was post-SS and NS, is that wives, older wives in this case, had to adjust to a decline in their standard of living. They were being provided with maintenance to allow them to adjust to a decline in standard of living. It couldn't possibly have been because anyone thought they were going back into work or to achieve a higher or a, you know, income. So I think it's been incredibly disappointing. I haven't seen a joint lives for over a decade. I personally haven't seen that.
I think this really brings into sharp focus, doesn't it, the difference in approach to those divorcing couples who have a lot of money and those that don't. So when there are significant resources, unless the marriage is deemed to be short, if I put that in inverted commas, because obviously you can have raging arguments about what that means. But the general preponderance of opinion tends to be in those sorts of cases that you start with a Duxbury, isn't it? You don't start looking at maintenance because you don't need to look at maintenance because there's lots of money. And so nobody really gets into the how much for how long, because it's a sharing case and there's plenty to go around. And I had a case very recently that was right on the cusp, but the husband was very wealthy, but it wasn't a very, very long marriage, but the wife had very particular needs. And if he had not been a wealthy man, I suspect that her claims would have been very limited indeed. But because he was a wealthy man, her claims are far more expansive and are likely to be determined on a Duxbury basis reasonably generously. So there is almost now those people who are falling into a needs-based income award being really scrutinised very, very heavily by the court. And as Fahana says, actually limited, very limited, in the terms of maintenance that they're achieving, even though perhaps, you know, a long marriage and trying to find their feet all over again after many years of marriage, perhaps children and being out of the workplace. And judges now almost applying, if you like, a kind of rough justice of, well, it's not a meal ticket for life. Income isn't for sharing. You'll have to get on with it. And it's I share Fahana's view that I think for some women, it can be really tough if you're looking at a needs based award to actually get a reasonable level of maintenance for a reasonable term.
Mm. We've had the authors of the Fair Shares report come on the podcast just before Christmas, and we talked about maintenance a bit with them, and they were talking about not the big money cases. You know, you probably read in the Fair Shares report, obviously most of the cases that are agreed or before the courts, people have limits on their income, limits on their capital. But they found that only one in five orders included any term of maintenance. They said 88% of those were for fixed terms. And what they were saying to us is that the terms that were being looked at were very much linked with when people had particular needs, so particularly around caring for children. So they were telling us that very much dispels, you know, a lot of the press that talks about meal tickets for life and let me just press the two of you. If you are not looking at a big money case where there are huge amounts of resources, what is it on a practice level that you would be looking at to link your term to try and work out what the right point is for agreeing an order?
For me, I would say obviously the most common reason is children, particularly young children. So you're looking at saying, well, if I've got a child and I can't go back to work, at what point is it reasonable for me to go back to work? So if you've got a child in primary school, that may be the child going to secondary school. If you've got children who've just started in secondary school, perhaps the end of secondary education, if you've got a more generous judge. The other time I think that maintenance orders obviously fall in is where you've got an older couple and you're bridging the gap between the time of the order and a pension falling in. So that where one party's got an income and you're, the other party's waiting for a pension, that's the other time that you could see there's a specific term order required to bridge that gap until pension falls in. So those to me are the obvious ones for term orders. And then, of course, you have the vexed argument of if it's going to be a term, is there going to be a Section 28(1)(a) bar? And I think we're now pretty settled in the law that where there's children, you don't impose a Section 28(1)(a) bar. But obviously, if you're looking at a term to get you to a point, for example, a pension drawdown, then I would expect most judges at that point would impose a bar.
Yes, and I would agree entirely with that, Sally. It's very often the term is going to be based or centred on children and dependency. You occasionally get a case where it's going to be based on retraining, where the spouse, the wife, let's say, is going to retrain and try and achieve a higher earning capacity or achieve a earning capacity. You know, occasionally there may be a windfall which is due or at some future point for whatever reason. It's not often, but that may be factored in, but almost always the children. I mean, the difficulty, of course, even when I think of my 20-year practice, at one point, dependency for children probably did mean 18, but that did change. Dependency for children, based on some cases, might be age 7. You know, it's really brought down. So the terms are shorter. They're much, much shorter than I used to see. And I suppose, interestingly, looking at the Fair Shares report, the argument that it's only 22% of people who would obtain a spousal maintenance award might be argument for reform, in fact, because it's not that many. And Anita, if I'm not wrong, the 22% who achieve it are actually from the cohort of the one third who obtain an order in any event, because two thirds of people don't actually get any type of order. So you only have one third obtaining an order, and of that, 22% are getting a spousal maintenance award. There's also recognition that came in Fair Shares, which is most people want a clean break. And I can't think of one single person I've acted for who doesn't want a clean break, including the impoverished payee. They often want a clean break and they want to root out. But unfortunately, they need to be supported. They need a regular sum of money to support them. But the one thing that also really concerns me, if I'm honest, is not just our legal climate, which has become very hawkish, but the fact that socioeconomically, in fact, women aren't doing so well anyway. So we had 1973, which we had our Matrimonial Causes Act. Only 50% of women were in work at that point. And it's absolutely fair to say that as of 2023, there's about 72% of women in work. So we definitely see more women in the workplace, but are they doing very well? Now, the Fair Shares report says probably not, that even 5 years after divorce, women haven't actually been able to improve their financial position, whereas men not very often do well after divorce financially. But also when one looks at the pension gap, the pension sharing gap, some wonderful work having been done by Deborah Price at Manchester, who I think at a recent talk I was listening to, she talks about how a divorced woman's pension wealth is one fifth that of a man. And I think her figure was around 20 grand for a woman and 100k for a man, let alone the pay gap, which we still see, which is still significant for men and women. And for older women, the pay gap over 50s women, it's about 20%. So we have a climate where it's not great for women. And I almost feel as though the statutory climate has gone ahead of the socioeconomic climate, that the law is trying to achieve something, in terms of the clean break or the very short term, which isn't actually reflective of the reality of many people's lives. So that is something that troubles me a great deal.
Right, moving on to capitalizing then. So we've had a look at had a brief look at quantum. Obviously, we've got stuck into term, but if there is the money to capitalize, and I'm going to come to you first, Sally, should we always be using Duxbury now?
For those that know me, many will have heard me speak on this subject and know that I have a very strong view about Duxbury that isn't shared by the judiciary. But I think we only need really to lift our heads a little bit above the parapet on this issue and see what's going on in other jurisdictions. So, for example, the equivalent to our Duxbury tables in personal injury cases are the Ogden tables. And at the moment, the eighth edition has been published, and they have a minus 0.25% rate of return in England and Wales. They're different in Northern Ireland, etc. But in England and Wales, it's minus 2.5%, as against our positive 3.75%. And I was really quite pleased to see in 2018 a couple of reported decisions where there were opportunities potentially for the envelope to be slightly opened on this issue. Two in particular, HC and FW, a decision of Mr. Justice Cobb, where he had a wife who was suffering from neurological and cognitive disabilities. And it was urged upon him that actually the Ogden tables would be a far better use of a multiplier calculation for her future income needs than the Duxbury tables. And he declined to do that. He followed Duxbury. And then the Court of Appeal in the same year considered the case of Tattersall, in which the first instance judge had used the Ogden tables to assess the wife's ongoing income needs. But sadly, the husband and wife appeared in person, and that particular aspect of the case wasn't fully argued before the Court of Appeal. Although they endorsed the Duxbury as the way forward, the issue of whether the judge was right or wrong in his use of the Ogden tables was never really dealt with legally, as it were, because the parties were in person and it wasn't a ground of appeal. Much, much more recently, Mr. Justice Cobb has been. I had another case in front of him in which the issue of Duxbury versus Ogden was discussed, albeit it wasn't really the centre of the case because it was a very unusual case in which the wife was seeking to capitalise a child maintenance order against a history of non-payment. And he didn't give a firm view. What he said was he needed to use an actual multiplier for the years remaining of the child's dependency. So he didn't say, I prefer Ogden to Duxbury. He simply said, I'm going to take an actual multiplier in this particular and unusual circumstances of that case. So we still really haven't had anybody say it will ever be permissible to look at Ogden as opposed to Duxbury. And so the starting point is always going to be Duxbury. And of course, for those that have ever consulted an IFA on this issue, and the nice thing about practice in Northern Ireland is you can have your own experts and you can have as many experts as you want. There is no limitation as we have on single joint experts and necessity. So if you were to instruct an IFA to actually undertake a calculation to work out what you would actually need to produce, let's say, £20,000 a year for the rest of your life as a 48-year-old woman, it would bear no resemblance whatsoever to a Duxbury table. And of course, clients are often encouraged to take independent financial advice in the middle of proceedings, and they go off and they take their advice and they come back and say, well, how can you possibly advise me to accept a lump sum at that level? It isn't going to come close to meeting my income needs. And we as practitioners simply have to say, well, yes, I understand that. And I can try and argue this. But the reality is that the best we're going to do is to push the judge to take your income needs at their highest and go for a full Duxbury. But as Farhana's already said, you know, we have all been the subject of having budgets quite aggressively pruned by judges when they're even when they're looking at a full life award on a Duxbury basis. So I think that there's a real issue underlying all of this. And it would be lovely to see the Duxbury Tables considered again. I was thinking about one of the years, and I'm sorry, I can't remember when it was, but I'm sure your listeners will recall, well, certainly those of you that are old enough to remember this, but there was a year where At a Glance actually published two sets of Duxbury Tables with different rates of return. And I, because I'm a bit sad like that, got very excited about that. And so the following year, I went immediately to the Duxbury Tables because it's the first thing I always do when At a Glance lands. And I was really disappointed because we went back to one. And so it is. And I suspect that obviously Duxbury is a tool, not a rule, but it's a very useful tool. And it's a very easy way of a judge assessing a lifetime award on a capitalized basis when that's appropriate. And so I think certainly for foreseeable, I think we are going to be still using Duxbury.
We asked Mr. Justice Mustin about this, didn't we, Anita, when he was on the podcast, because he's a member of the Duxbury Committee. And I've had this conversation with another member of the Duxbury Committee as well. And they say, well, you misunderstand it if you think that the purpose of a Duxbury Award is to produce a certain amount of income for a certain number of years. What it is a tool for fixing the price that needs to be paid in order to purchase a clean break in that particular. I mean, do you have any truck with that argument?
I think that it's a very nice way of getting around the issue, isn't it? Because it enables you to justify it. But I think actually the other way of looking at it down the telescope is if you're on the receiving end of it, as the party who actually is going to be given that amount of money, because that's how a judge has looked at it. A judge has said, this is how much I think you're going to need to survive for the rest of your life. And you know, whatever the intention of the committee, the reality on the ground for parties who are the subject of a capitalised maintenance award is they will get it on a Duxbury basis. And I think the only ways around that for parties who feel that a Duxbury is going to be particularly unfair is to think about whether or not there should be a cessation of amortization. So in other words, to take the Waggett approach and say, is it fair that I should have my Duxbury fund amortized from the get-go? And I think in my experience in practice, the ones where the cases where that is really to the fore are those cases where you have a particularly high earning, and it's usually the husband, but a particularly high earning husband and a wife who's stuck with a Duxbury fund, and he is going to earn in a relatively short time what she's being paid out as a Duxbury for the rest of her life. And in those cases, and they are rare, I have managed to persuade judges to agree not to immediately amortise and to give either a period without amortisation or a short-term maintenance order. And of course, that's what Mr Justice Francis did in O'Dwyer, although he reduced the amount of maintenance that had been ordered by his Honour Judge O'Dwyer in the first instance. He still left the maintenance order in place for the wife in the particular circumstances of that case. So there are ways, I think, of mitigating it, but they are few and far between. And of course, the other way of mitigating it is to vary the rate of return. But I've never successfully argued that.
Fahana, on a separate subject, you told us that you were the founder of the Family Law Menopause Project. Do you want to tell us something about that project and what your findings were, and then perhaps weave that into the maintenance discussion that we're having?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just menopause, just in a straightforward way in terms of definition, is when a woman's period comes to an end. And it's a retrospective diagnosis. So you have to wait a year, it's come to an end, then you're into menopause as a woman. And what actually happens is your ovaries stop producing eggs. And so a woman's hormones deplete. So it's her progesterone, her testosterone, her estrogen. But alongside that, you have the period up to menopause, which is the perimenopause, and women can be quite symptomatic. Some women are really quite symptomatic, and Some of the symptoms are hot flushes, insomnia, fatigue, mood changes, palpitations, anxiety, panic attacks. So quite a range of symptoms. And the analysis has been that for a quarter of women, those symptoms will be quite profound. There'll be a quarter of women who actually the symptoms don't bother them, or very few symptoms. And then a half of women who do get symptoms which impact them, but they wouldn't describe as being profound. And there's been lots of work done by doctors and menopause specialists looking just in general terms, and it's probably worth just talking about it for a moment, and how it might impact women. And the big headlines was that when 1 in 10 women, the Fawcett report had said 1 in 10 women had left work. But there were also the women who had reduced their working hours, 59% of women who'd taken time off work, or 21% of women who'd passed up the chance on a promotion. The situation is exacerbated by workplaces not necessarily offering menopause support, HRT still being low on the ground, although there's a big push for it. There's approximately only 14% of women who access HRT. So there's a range of problems around this. And it became very clear to me, particularly as I got older and with the clients I was dealing with, that this was an issue in my consulting room as I was discussing it with women. It's probably fair to say there's a lot of ignorance and shame surrounding it. So what I did was to do a small level survey, really asking lawyers what they thought. And 81% of lawyers did acknowledge that they do not ask, do not consider it, and do not discuss it with their clients. So they're absolutely blind to it. But alongside that interesting result, 65% of family lawyers acknowledged that they think women are being financially prejudiced by this lack of understanding and knowledge of menopause. From my point of view, what it seems to clearly go towards is earning capacity. And this is kind of, I realize I'm that there's a hawkish culture in any event, and this only adds to the probably infuriation and the of some of the judiciary who won't be happy. I think there's a lot of people who won't be happy to hear this. But in any event, I did proceed with a survey to ask the wider public, to ask women really what they think. There were some big headlines that came from that, where 7 in 10 women reported that they felt menopause was impacting their marriage, to the point where many felt that it led to a divorce. So you see an increase of divorce between 45 to 55. Statistically, that's the highest period of divorce. Menopause, perimenopause, 45 to 55. Menopause is actually age 51. So you can see there's a correlation. I'm not saying there's causation, but you can see they're correlated. And we know it goes to earning capacity because that's what women are reporting. The other survey results, which I found very interesting, were that 67% of women thought it increased domestic abuse and arguments within their relationship and marriage. 80% thought it put a strain on their family life and children. This is with or without divorce, by the way. It was putting a strain on family life. Women said 97% of lawyers did not discuss it with them, and that they felt that judges and lawyers needed training, that they felt as though they were being let down by family lawyers and the judiciary when it came to this. There were also some really interesting results about how menopausal women or perimenopausal women felt that they would have benefited from dispute resolution as opposed to court, because court can be very difficult if you are giving evidence, if you can't remember the facts, if you don't seem consistent, dealing with deadlines. So there was a range of issues around that women reported. But also women reported that they felt that they were being financially prejudiced themselves, that they couldn't see how they could make pension savings or savings if they felt they couldn't work or they were going to be shortchanged by the court. So it was a range of really interesting results, Simon. And I think the problem is that family lawyers still, bearing in mind we're a 70% female profession, I think are still not very good at interpreting this or asking the questions. I would definitely want to see onboarding, which asked whether perimenopause and menopause was having an impact on their finances, in their relationships, so that we as family lawyers could factor it in.
Thanks, Hannah. I mean, it sounds, Sally, as though when we're talking about building the matrix of need, as it were, when we're looking at age, we're looking at children's ages, we're looking at earning capacity, we're looking at health, we're looking at all those things, aren't we? And this does seem to be something that we ought to be adding into that matrix.
I agree. And I think that the point Fahana makes is a really interesting one about almost embarrassment and shame for women, that somehow to say I am struggling with the symptoms of menopause for a client is shameful for her, embarrassing, it's difficult, it's awkward. And I think as lawyers, we need to be facilitating that and importantly, educating the judiciary about that. Because, you know, like it or not, it's getting better. Of course, it's getting better. We're getting more and more judges who are women. But actually, you know, for a long time, it has been a male bastion. And it's always been, you know, difficult, I think, for women to express that. That very personal aspect of their life to a judge, and particularly, as Fahana said, you know, if you're going to court and you're giving evidence. And we've all seen clients, haven't we, really struggle sometimes to recollect things, female clients in conference, really struggling with the facts, having gaps in their memory. And it's very easy then, isn't it, when you're in court and you have your client being cross-examined, for that lapse in memory to be misinterpreted as in some way not being clear, not giving good evidence, and not being credible, whereas perhaps a husband who has very clear thought is much more able to enunciate their case to the judge and perhaps comes across as a far more appealing witness to a judge in court than perhaps a wife who's struggling and feeling very uncomfortable. So I agree. I think that there does need to be a much more open discussion about this and a lot more thought given to how we deal with it and where it fits in the matrix that we have at the moment of Section 25.
That's really interesting. I suppose that calls into question the you know, the way we approach these cases, isn't it? I mean, so much turns on oral evidence on the day. And, you know, is that a good way to be judging these things? But yeah, thank you. That was really interesting. Can we talk about nominal maintenance? And, well, A, does it exist? Does it exist as this nebulous safety net? Has anyone ever successfully triggered a nominal maintenance award? And if it doesn't exist, is it something that we should all just stop doing and stop arguing for? So Fahana, could I come to you first on that?
Sure. I mean, in fact, thinking about menopause, I could envisage a scenario where it's almost a prophylactic award, but you may well have a wife who is on that brink of being unsure whether she's going to work and how she's going to work, where in fact a nominal award for that type of payee could be a very useful device. I can see how that flies in the face of the clean break culture. But I actually think nominal maintenance could be a very interesting device when it comes to menopause. But I, when I was practicing a number of years ago, would typically write these clauses in. I would use these clauses to get the child to 18. So substantive maintenance may taper off. I'd have a nominal award. Occasionally, I would, you know, you just have the nominal award just as a safety net for children's dependency. But I can see with the case of A&M, 2021 case of Nicholas Mostyn, that, you know, it's become a symbolic irritant. He talks about how there's never been a case where nominal award has been successfully enlarged. Of course, he wouldn't know whether nominal awards are being very successfully negotiated into substantive awards, because he wouldn't know what's happening in mediation. So I think there is a lot of negotiation that goes on or used to go on. But I can also take the point that one wouldn't want the payer to be an insurance policy in case something goes horribly wrong. You know, lots of things can go wrong in life.
All right, Sally, come on, you tell us. Have you ever managed to convert a nominal award into a substantive award?
You know, I'm sorry to say the answer to that is yes, I have. Well, I'm not sorry, actually. I'm very pleased to say the answer to that is yes, I have. It was a very long time ago, and it was a really tricky case where the husband really didn't have very much money. In fact, he'd had himself declared bankrupt during the course of the proceedings, but the wife was very, very poorly. And I managed to persuade the judge that because he was in the future likely to inherit a lot of money and she had very particular needs that he couldn't meet or wouldn't meet now, that there should be a nominal maintenance order. And I was really delighted because it was in a northern court. It was actually Bolton County Court in front of a really difficult district judge who really didn't like giving maintenance per se. But she did agree. And about 10 years later, the same client came back to me and she was still poorly, but she was thankfully managing to get on with her life. But by then, the husband had inherited a huge amount of money. So we went back to court armed with our budget. We varied the nominal maintenance upwards and capitalized it. And she managed to get a significant lump sum as a result of it. Now, you know, after the way in which Mr. Justice Mostyn attacked nominal maintenance orders in his decision that Fahana's made reference to, I'm not sure that given the same set of circumstances again, that I would have succeeded in getting a nominal maintenance order. I think that they are becoming a rarity. And the only time I ever see nominal maintenance orders is where you have an agreement for child maintenance and a concern that somebody's going to go to the CMS and the wife's going to be left with no protection. But it would that fall foul of lots of authority on that particular point? But more importantly, would it fall foul of it being used as a safety net and a judge not awarding it, albeit that it's a clause that's regularly put into, as Fahana says, consent orders after the parties have managed to reach an agreement. So they are now, I think, becoming a thing of the past. But I agree with Fahana that they are an important part of orders, but not something I think judges are going to be looking at for very much longer.
We come on to the thorny subject of variation then, because quite often once your clients had a maintenance order made against them, the immediate next question is, well, you know, when can we go back and get rid of it? So tell us about variation. Does it mean going through the entire process all over again? Is it a retrial? What's going on?
I always find with variation of maintenance cases that in the vast majority of the variation cases that I've done, it's the husband who brings it back. And in my experience, the reason that the husband brings it back is because sitting behind him is his new wife, who hates the fact that every month there is a standing order that leaves his account to his ex-wife. And you always have that first conference with them when they say, do you know that in the past 5 years I've paid, and then they calculate exactly to the penny, exactly how much maintenance they've paid and how incredibly wrong it is. In my experience, it's actually very rare to find women bringing maintenance orders back. They, unless they want to capitalize, unless there's a specific event that's happened in their husband's, ex-husband's lives that mean that the time is right to capitalize. And obviously we see those cases, but they don't tend to be just give me more money. They tend to be, I just want a clean break now. Please, can I have a lump sum because he is now in a position to pay me so that I can leave the marriage. But in the pure variation, I don't want to have to pay so much. In fact, I don't want to pay anything at all. In fact, I don't even want to pay a lump sum cases. Those, in my experience, are the ones that are driven by men. And that they are an interesting hybrid, aren't they, of need and fairness and not revisiting the whole set of circumstances, but still having regard to what a fair outcome is going to look like. And I have to say, in my experience, I never find them satisfactory. Perhaps it's because I'm either representing a wife who has huge expectations of being able to revisit the entire original order and come away with an enormous lump sum, or I'm for a husband who really doesn't want to pay anything else, or rather his new wife doesn't want him to pay anything else because he thinks he's paid more than enough already. And so they are, I think, really tricky applications. And I have to say, if I have a client who comes to me to say, should I make a variation application, my invariable advice is, unless you really have to rock the boat, unless there's a really good reason to do it, then let sleeping dogs lie. Although, as I say, in my experience, the ones that fight are the ones where it's the new wife who really, really won't countenance yet another month of a standing order going out of their new husband's bank account to his ex-wife.
Is that experience of how difficult and expensive variation applications are, is that not the strongest argument against joint lives maintenance? Because joint lives orders are made in the expectation that they will be varied at some point.
No, I agree. And exactly that, because those are the cases now that we're seeing, aren't they? You know, the old, if you like, the old joint lives maintenance orders that are coming back years later because people's circumstances have changed, perhaps inheritances have fallen in, perhaps redundancies have fallen in. And those are the ones that we're seeing, because of course life is never a straight line and there are always financial ups and downs, and that's what triggers litigation to be revisited. And I agree. I'm not sure though, Simon, I would agree that simply because a joint lives maintenance order may lead to a capitalization application or a variation application, that's an argument not to have a joint lives maintenance order. I think that if there's a need for a joint lives maintenance order, there's a need for a joint lives maintenance order. What comes of that down the line will come of that down the line. I don't think it's an argument per se to say we shouldn't. And certainly the most recent case that I did for variation, we ended up in arbitration. And that worked really well. And I'm sure, you know, your listeners will be more than familiar with how sometimes certain applications do lend themselves very, very well to arbitration. And I certainly found that on a variation application, it was a very clean, neat, easy way of dealing with what could otherwise have been a protracted, messy, expensive application.
But in practice, I find it incredibly difficult, because you are starting largely afresh. You are considering the change in circumstances, but you really don't know which way it's going to go. And I was recently reading the case of WK and GC, the His Honour Judge Hess case from last year. And in this very interesting case, I found it interesting. Wife was age 60 and husband was 67. And husband coming up to retirement wanted to effectively eliminate maintenance if he could. And Judge Hess actually told his wife that she had an earning capacity, so assessed an earning capacity of another 7 years. So she had some income that way. She had to amortize her non-matrimonial capital, so she had an income that way. And then for the balance, he capitalized it using Duxbury. So that's such an unusual creative way of looking at it, which actually talks about the unpredictability of these cases. One doesn't know what the judge is going to do. So it's definitely a far better to see if one can negotiate it or have effective mediation in trying to resolve these type of cases, I think.
Thank you both. That was absolutely fascinating. And to our listeners, if you like what you've heard, please leave us a review.